Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for March 10th, 2015. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'm talking with Richard Neutze about a new structural study of the photoreceptor rhodopsin. Rhodopsin is a G-protein-coupled receptor that initiates signaling in response to light. It has seven membrane-spanning helices, and it's embedded in the plasma membrane. Rhodopsin is most abundant in rod cells of the retina, where it's important for seeing in dim light. When it's struck by light, its conformation changes, and this triggers intracellular signaling through G proteins. As with other integral membrane proteins, being in the cell membrane is very important for the proper structure and function of rhodopsin. So studying rhodopsin in its native environment is the ideal way to see how its structure relates to its function. Several structures of rhodopsin have been solved, but these structural studies were done on protein that had been removed from the membrane and solubilized with detergents. Also, crystal structures offer only a static view of a protein instead of showing it in action. In a new study published this week in Science Signaling, a group led by Richard Neutze used time-resolved wide-angle X-ray scattering to study light-induced conformational changes in the structure of rhodopsin in a native membrane and in real time. Neutze spoke to me from the University of Göteborg in Sweden. Dr. Neutze, welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast.
Thank you.
When light strikes rhodopsin, how does that induce intracellular signaling?
Everybody will be familiar with the fact that light enters your eye, and once it passes through the lens, it focuses back into the retina. And the retina contains light-sensitive cells, which are called photoreceptor cells. Now, rhodopsin is found in all photoreceptor cells, and the ones that we isolated from are classed as rod cells. And the rod cells are sensitive to black and light vision when it's very dark, when there's dim light. So most people will be familiar with the fact that in very low light conditions, you see in black and white rather than seeing in color. And that's the rod cells that are giving you that vision. Now, rhodopsin is a light-sensitive protein. It changes its structure in response to light. So a photon comes in, it is absorbed in the protein, and that causes it to change its structure. Now, the reason why it changes its structure is it wants to go from a conformation that is not able to bind a protein, which is called transducin in this case, to a structure where it can bind that protein. Now, that protein is classified as a G protein, and that's why rhodopsin is called a G protein coupled receptor. It belongs to the family of G protein coupled receptors that bind G proteins, and when they bind G proteins, they start a signaling cascade in your body. This is also used in many other types of receptors, for example, smell or taste or many other types of receptors are G-protein-coupled receptors. But rhodopsin is the light G-protein-coupled receptor in your body. When rhodopsin is activated by light, it then binds the G-protein called transducin, and binding transducin changes the properties of transducin. So the transducin becomes activated. It's then released, and that then deactivates a phosphodiesterase, another protein, which leads to a change in the concentration of cyclic GMP, which eventually causes an ion channel to close, and this leads to a buildup of an ion gradient across the membrane, and that process is called hyperpolarizing the membrane. And it's this hyperpolarization of the membrane that initiates the propagation of a signal along the optical nerve and eventually into your brain.
Most of the previous structural studies of rhodopsin relied on crystallized protein, which represents only a static picture of the protein, but it has very, very high resolution. You can really see the details of the molecule. In this study, you used time-resolved wide-angle X-ray scattering to probe the structure of rhodopsin in a membrane, not in a crystal. How does that technique compare with X-ray crystallography in terms of resolution?
Well, X-ray crystallography is a very mature field, a very beautiful method. And the great beauty of crystallography is, as you pointed out, you can get very high resolution, detailed structural information. So, for example, pioneering and very important work was from the Parchesky Laboratory in 2000, when they published the first structure of rhodopsin, which was also the first structure of a G-protein coupled receptor. Some 8 years later, the first structures of activated forms of rhodopsin emerged from another lab, from the lab of Olivia Ernst and Klaus-Peter Hoffmann. And since then, there's been a number of other structures contributed, which have looked in more and more detail at how structural changes might occur in rhodopsin, including some work from our collaborator, Gebhard Schittler, who was co-author on this paper. Now, the great thing about crystallography structures is that when you have a high enough resolution, you can see, you already visualize electron density. And electron density is very beautiful because you can put into that electron density the positions of atoms and side chains. And when the resolution is good enough, when the quality is good enough, it's really a fantastic technique. But one of the drawbacks of crystallography is that you have to have crystals in order to get any useful information, and those crystals have to be very well ordered. So that means that the protein conformation that you want to study has to be able to pack within a crystal lattice. And especially if you want to look at large structural changes, which is what we're looking at, the activation of rhodopsin by light, then it's very difficult, for example, to crystallize the resting structure and then trigger it and see the full conformational change, because the structural change will be so big it will completely destroy that crystal lattice. And therefore, you won't be able to see with diffraction the very structural changes that you want to see. So the method that we used is called time-resolved wide-angle X-ray scattering. It doesn't work on crystals. It works on samples in suspension. So in our case, we use suspensions of native disk membranes containing rhodopsin isolated from the rod cell. And because it's not crystalline, we don't have this very beautiful order of a crystal lattice, so that the X-rays scatter from an ensemble of randomly orientated molecules. Now, that ensemble of randomly orientated molecules means that we can't get the detailed structural information that we can get in principle from crystallography. But the advantage is that you can trigger and induce a conformational change in your sample without the risk or the hindrance of the crystal lattice, and you can really follow that with time. So it's a complementary method to crystallography.
It gives you more information about the dynamics of the protein structure and less detail about its fine structure.
Yeah, time-resolved wide-angle X-ray scattering is a method that's been developed purely for the case of looking at dynamics. So it builds from an earlier method called small-angle X-ray scattering, a very low-resolution method that can give you some globular information about a protein structure and how proteins can arrange at a very, very low resolution. Wide-angle scattering is able to look at slightly more detailed information, slightly higher angle X-ray scattering, slightly higher resolution, but well short of what you can achieve with crystallography. But it's built purely to see dynamics, to see how things change in time. And that is the advantage of the method.
Protein conformational changes are very, very fast. How well can you measure those changes with your technique?
So we use synchrotron radiation in the study that we did on rhodopsin, published this week in Science Signaling. And one can understand synchrotron radiation as a continuous source. Like you could imagine, if you think about a laser pointer as a continuous source. The way we achieved the time resolution in that case was using the properties of the X-ray detector. So we used an X-ray detector that could read the X-ray scattering very rapidly. And the detector that was developed at the Swiss Light Source, where we did these studies, could read out frames with a time resolution of about 10 milliseconds or 1/100th of a second. And that enabled us to trigger and to follow and record a movie of a sequence of X-ray scattering images with 10 millisecond resolution. Alternative ways of doing this type of experiment is to go to sources where you have short pulse X-ray sources. So you can do this at very specialized X-ray beams at synchrotron sources, or at a later development as an X-ray free electron laser, which is a new X-ray source coming after synchrotrons, which is causing a lot of excitement today in the X-ray field. And at an X-ray free electron laser, it's actually possible to use the same technique, time-resolved wide-angle scattering, to go down to a time resolution which is much faster, down to a picosecond, which is a billionth of a second. So there is a whole range of all the interesting timescales in photobiology, the biology of sensitivity to light. One can look at dynamics from picosecond timescales to millisecond timescale to second timescales, depending on the scientific question that you're asking. And in this particular case, you're interested in the active conformation of rhodopsin, which becomes activated on a timescale of about 1/100th of a second. And the way we could detect this and view this was well matched to the properties of the X-ray detector.
So how does rhodopsin react when the light strikes it? What happens in that 100th of a second?
So rhodopsin gets its ability to respond to light because it contains a molecule that's light sensitive. In the case of rhodopsin, the chromophore is called a retinal molecule. Now, a retinal molecule can be bent or it can be straight, depending on the chemical conformation of it. And in the resting state of rhodopsin, to be rather technically speaking, it starts in an 11-trans conformation, which means it's bent roughly in the middle, a little bit like a banana being bent. Now, when that absorbs the photon, there's an isomerization around one bond, a double bond, and then isomerization straightens it out. So you can imagine that you've got a bent banana, which then becomes a straight banana, inside a protein. Now, since the pocket which contains the bent banana isn't ideally matched for a straight banana, then the protein has to change structure to respond to this change of structure of the chromophore. So what it does is it certain side chains change, and then a signal propagates from the center of the protein where the isomerization of the retinal happens out, and the protein changes structure. And in particular, rhodopsin contains 7 alpha helices, which go up and down through the membrane. Well, one of these alpha helices in particular, called helix 6, undergoes a very significant and large movement, an outward tilt. Now, this outward tilt leads to a movement of about 10 angstroms, and that movement is large enough to then accommodate the straightened retinal. And this new conformation with helix 6 moved significantly, and helix 5 also moving along with helix 6, is a conformation which is tuned or has evolved to be sensitive and accept transducers to come along and bind and be activated. So it goes from a conformation where it doesn't interact with the G-protein transducer to a conformation where it is optimized to interact with the G-protein transducer. And this interaction causes complementary changes in the protein transducer, which begin the signaling cascade that we talked about before.
How do your observations about the conformational changes that take place in rhodopsin when it's activated fit with what was already known from the crystal structures of rhodopsin?
I would like to start by saying that the method of time-resolved wide-angle scattering is complementary to crystallography. It builds on the knowledge that has been found by others using crystallographic techniques. When we collected the time-resolved X-ray scattering data, and we could see how this changed with time and timescales of a few milliseconds, then we needed to interpret how the changes in X-ray scattering corresponded to changes in structure. So what we did is we took the knowledge that had already been built up by other people's work using crystallography, and we used that to guide our interpretation of the data. Now, when we went through this process of guided structural fitting to our wide-angle X-ray scattering data, we came to the conclusion that the movement of helix 6 that I was talking about and the corresponding movement of helix 5, it turned out that this was quite a lot larger than what was seen in the earlier crystal structures of rhodopsin. And strictly speaking, about not quite twice as big, but about 80% larger. Now, this seems to be quite a big distinction. It's to be 80% larger seems like quite a different result. But one of the interesting observations that we also made is that there has been crystal structures solved of other G-protein coupled receptors when they interact with their G-protein. And in particular, very famous work from the laboratory of Brian Kobolka has shown a crystal structure of a G-protein coupled receptor called beta-2 adrenergic receptor in complex with its G-protein, bound. And when we compare the structure that we recovered with the method of time-resolved wide-angle scattering with the on-rhodopsin and the conformation of the beta-2 adrenergic receptor when it had its G-protein bound, it actually turned out that those structures are very, very similar. So even though our structure was 80% larger than movements seen for rhodopsin, it was pretty much bang on what had been seen and observed for another G-protein-coupled receptor. So that makes us get the conclusion that it seems rather plausible that indeed it really might be true that rhodopsin has a significantly larger conformational change in its native membrane environments than had previously been seen in crystal structures. And that said, I don't want this to be like a criticism of crystal structures. I think that work is very, very beautiful. But it illustrates the complementary nature of this method and how it can complement other work that's been done because we don't have the restriction of the crystal lattice in our studies. We believe that this sort of solves perhaps a conflict between a crystal structure of a G-protein-coupled receptor in complex with its G-protein, done for the beta-2 arginine receptors, and why did they seem to have a larger conformational change than seen for rhodopsin. Our work would indicate that, in fact, that full conformational change truly does happen in native membranes for rhodopsin after light activation.
The particular technique that you used to look at the structure here, time-resolved wide-angle X-ray scattering, requires a lot of material. It requires a lot of protein to do those sorts of experiments. How did you get those vast amounts of protein that you need for these experiments? And is it feasible to think that you could gather that much material, enough to do these experiments, for other types of GPCRs?
The answer to how we got a lot of material was that Eric and Petra worked very hard. They spent a lot of time in the darkroom isolating and preparing rhodopsin. One of the difficulties with rhodopsin is that once you activate it, it doesn't go back to where it started from again. You need to have other proteins to recover the original structure of rhodopsin, at least for bovine rhodopsin. So that meant that we couldn't reuse the protein that we'd activated with light. Some of the other studies that people have done with time-resolved wide-angle X-ray scattering, and that have been done from my lab as well, have been studying other proteins where, in fact, the protein will return to its starting point after light activation. And then because you can recycle the protein, you don't have to use as much. If we wanted to use this method to study the interactions of other key protein-coupled receptors, then we'd have to develop new techniques because other G-protein-coupled receptors are not light-sensitive. They're triggered by the binding of a ligand. So if we wanted to study other, for example, smell-sensitive receptors, then we would need to activate these by soaking in ligands in some way. This would certainly be a challenge, partly because of the technical difficulties with mixing and doing very accurate measurements while mixing with X-ray scattering, and partly, as what you alluded to, that we would have to express and produce a very large amount of G-protein-coupled receptors. But it's a challenge for the future. I think it can be done, and it'd be interesting to do it, but it is a new avenue for the field of wide-angle scattering.
Thank you, Richard, for speaking with me.
Carol, thank you, and Lisa, for your time and effort. It was a pleasure.
That was Richard Neutze discussing a paper published in the March 10th issue of Science Signaling by Malmerberg and colleagues. You can read that article online at stke.sciencemag.org. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.